Hey, this is comedian Mark Maron, and I love Mr. Media Radio, even though he didn't let me go on as long as some other guests.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to John Fricke, author of a new coffee table filmography, Judy, A Legendary Film Career. Stick around. We're going to see how many of you knew that the Judy in the book's title is Judy Garland. Ah, oh, damn. There was going to be a test later. Well, we all better get A's. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview. You know, MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. Stop by and check it out. There are more than 900 archives, celebrity, and pop culture interviews for your listening pleasure. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of former gay icons who refuse to acknowledge their fabulosity in this world or the next in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida.
Clang, clang, clang went the trolley. Ding, ding, ding went the bell. Zing, zing, zing went my heart strings. From the moment I saw him, I fell.
Meet Me in St. Louis is the tender, romantic story of the most popular young beauty of the early 1900s, of her crush on the boy next door, of her lovable, yet at times humorous family.
If you like me like I like you, and we like both the same.
In the pantheon of movie stars who will live forever in the memories of cinema fans, few burn brighter than Judy Garland. She lived a well-documented life of extraordinariness from her big-screen breakthrough in The Wizard of Oz on through A Star is Born and Meet Me in St. Louis. There was no medium she couldn't conquer, whether it was movies, radio, or later, television. Wherever she went, whatever she did, she was universally respected for her God-given talent and adored for her smile and spunk. There have been, of course, entire bookshelves of research and publications devoted to the magic of Garland, and it could be argued that what the world didn't need was another coffee table book of pictures and facts about the actress who brought Dorothy Gale to life in 1939. But biographer John Fricke, who also wrote The Wizard of Oz, an illustrated companion to the timeless movie classic, knows his subject better than most, and found a fresh way to present his case for another print celebration of her life and art. Judy, A Legendary Film Career, breaks down the movies of the actress and singer into four parts of her life. It then entertains the reader with synopsis, cast lists, behind-the-scenes credits, musical numbers when appropriate, and photos. Lots and lots of great photos. If you love Judy Garland, you'll love this book. John Fricke, welcome to Mr. Media.
That's one of the best introductions and best summations of her career I think I've ever heard, Bob. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Can I write your next book?
Well, yes, and then I'll take over your job, and I have a feeling one of us is going to be doing better financially than the other.
Probably you.
Oh, then we're both in trouble. And I love the thing at the top of the show, too, about which Judy's had the legendary film career. I was thinking, Judy Canova, Judy Collins, you know, how many other Judys have there been in movie history?
Well, that's why we've got to keep the audience on their toes.
Well, that's fine.
So, now, I hope you didn't take any offense, but why did the world need another book about Judy Garland? I mean, were all the other ones sold out?
Well, that's part of it, including the previous five I've written on Oz and Judy one way or another. I think it's just that there's always a new generation, and books, of course, do go out of print. Judy, I think, more than most Hollywood celebrities, has fallen victim over the decades to a lot of misreportage and misinformation. I think part of the problem is that in many of the biographies and even many of the career analyses that have been done since she died in 1969, a lot of them were written in the immediate decade or so afterwards, when a lot of people were still alive, husbands, managers, directors, studio heads, and you had to tread very carefully. You could say she did this and this and this, but if the facts in some of those cases weren't especially appealing, you couldn't say why, because the reasons for any kind of misbehavior were still out there and litigious. So I think one of the reasons that it was nice to do this book, not only to celebrate a film career that went from 1929 to 1963, but a film career that was successful then, that has proved to be timeless, not because I say so, but because the fans still line up, and because you could put things into a little bit more perspective now. And as a fan, there are literally thousands of photographs of Judy Garland in books. There are thousands more that still have not been in books, and people enjoy looking at that. So one of the goals for this book was to get the facts straight, get the summaries straight about her life and times and work, and to provide another 500-some photographs that haven't been in prior books.
You stopped me dead there. Let me go back a second. You said there are thousands more photos of Judy Garland that have not been in books. Is that possible?
Oh, easily. Yes, definitely. I mean, we edited down the 550 in this book from about, maybe 1,500, which were our final choices for the project. And to get down to the 1,500, we probably looked at 3,000 or 4,000.
Consider my mind blown, because, I mean, as you know, I mean, she's been gone for decades. There have been
books.
She
hasn't posed lately.
Yeah, I mean, how is it that there are that many? I know she was photographed like crazy in her career, but there are thousands of. I mean, it blows my mind.
Well, and those are the ones that are extant. You know, you figure they probably took 1,500 shots, stills of every film she made, of all 34 feature films, say. And then they circulated maybe 300 of those. And even if the only film for which it's difficult to find previously unpublished art is Wizard of Oz, because of course that has been, you know, had its own history and its own series of books.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody turned up on the internet just this week a beautiful picture of her on the set of the Wizard of Oz that none of us had ever seen before. So the material is out there. It's just a question of digging. And I've been very fortunate in that the preceding work, the first book I did that related to Judy was published 22 years ago.
Wow.
And this is the sixth across those two decades plus. And one of the nicest things is that the books have been well received by the people who admire and respect her, so that the other fans and collectors who are on that plane have come to me and said, whatever I have, you can use for a future project. And that's what makes something like this possible. It's the generosity and the cooperation of a lot of people.
And you're saying that there are 515 photos in this book that have not been seen before?
I think there are probably 550 altogether.
50.
And
pardon
I
me.
Think perhaps 50 of them are redos, again, because it's difficult to find things about Oz that haven't been used before. None of the Oz photos have been used in any of my preceding Garland projects. I might have used them in an Oz project a couple decades ago, now out of print. But again, that is the approach. There are some that are from Garland books or that were used in Garland books in 1975, but that's a long time ago now. And they're worth, if they're really good pictures and really rare pictures, they're worth bringing up again or making the most of again. Also, with no reflection on the publishing industry, a lot of those books in the 70s weren't printed on this kind of stock. The reproductions of the photos weren't especially special.
Hmm.
And in this case, Running Press has done just a beautiful, beautiful job of bookmaking. The design is extraordinary and welcoming and exciting. And not that I'm prejudiced, but I didn't have anything to do with the design of this book. This was all done by someone they selected. And so it's very nice for an author to turn over all this material and have it turn out as well as it did. But a great gal named Susan Van Horn put all of this together from the copy and the artwork. And so, again, I would say 500 pictures that haven't been in a Garland book prior to this, and another 50 that haven't been around for a long time.
Well, and to give credit where credit is due, I don't usually talk about publishers, but this is definitely a specialty of Running Press. They do this type of book extremely well. I just saw their new book on Lucille Ball and Lucy and about the I Love Lucy series, and it's an astonishing book. It's in very much the same spirit of this. It's kind of chronological, and the photos that you see are, it's kind of mind-blowing, the photos in that book. And they just seem to do this very well.
Well, I think it's something that in which they believe. They've done Lucy at the movies. They've done Lana Turner. They've done Betty Davis, Frank Sinatra, Judy. I believe they have Liz Taylor coming later this year. And it's kind of a reminder of the fact that show business didn't start with Justin and Brittany, you know? And I think for some of us, that's a very welcome reminder.
Now, tell me a little bit about how you got started on this path. I mean, how many Judy and or Wizard books have you done now?
Three on Oz and three on Garland in the last 22 years, plus documentaries that I've co-produced or co-written that have been very well received. The PBS American Masters program on Garland in 2004 won Emmys. The A&E biography special on Judy in 1997 won the Emmy. CDs for Savoy Jazz and Capitol and Sony Special Products. The DVD commentary tracks and special features. It is amazing to have a hobby that starts when you're five evolve into a career some three decades after that. But it was when I was in my late 30s that this started to coalesce. And I'm 60 now, and it's kind of like, well, I hope I go for another 30 or 40 years because I got a lot more Garland books to share.
Well,
isn't that a frightening thought?
Well, I'll have to write a new intro sometime down the line. You know, how do you get started on this particular? Is it an obsession? Is it a career opportunity? How do you explain it?
I think it's a passion more than anything else, because I think you know, given the work you do, that we don't choose these things; they kind of choose us. And if it's something you love to do, you just find yourself in the middle of it. I started as a fan at age five with Wizard of Oz, first network telecast back in 1956. And I love music already at that age, and musical movies. But at age five, my big heroes were Walt Disney's Three Little Pigs. So to make the quantum leap to Dorothy and Company was kind of a jump. But it was just, I think, kind of meant to be, because we all, a bunch of people in our family, watched the movie that night, and they had a nice evening, and I walked away permanently scarred, but in a very nice way. And the enthusiasm I had for things already at that point in my life just really poured over when it came to that film. And my parents loved music and loved film, and so they encouraged me. It wasn't, you know, but a few weeks later that I found out that Judy Garland had record albums, that there was an Oz record album, that there was an Oz storybook, and that led to finding out that there was a series of 40 official Oz books published between 1900 and ultimately the last one was 1963,
mm-hmm.
That Judy had made other movies that were on the Milwaukee Late Show. I grew up in Wisconsin. And by the time I was 10 and she was playing Carnegie Hall and making that last huge comeback in the early 60s with Judgment at Nuremberg and the Academy Award nomination and some other films and her TV specials and her TV series and her concerts, I was thoroughly sold on all of this. And researched and collected for my own pleasure. And even at that age, it was like I wanted to know the backstory of the films and the concerts and the TV shows. I wasn't obsessed with her private life. It was the work that interested me, the achievement. And as I say, it was never supposed to become a career, but I've been very lucky. I had a background in journalism. I went to Northwestern University for college on a journalism scholarship. So writing was something I'd always done. And researching her and The Wizard of Oz was something I'd always done. And I sang full-time for many years in the from the mid-70s to the early 90s, but that kind of all took a back seat when the writing and the producing and speaking careers took off. I guess it was about a decade ago when I woke up one morning, I thought, well, obviously, John, this is what you're supposed to be doing with your life because it's what you're doing. And it's nice that people have found me capable of it. You know, I think there are a lot of people who would like to be doing some of the stuff that you do and that I do. And what we were lucky is that we were given the opportunities and then we had some kind of ability to see them through and to make them palatable to other people. Because if we're not being entertaining, there's not much point in doing this in whatever media we express ourselves.
And
now you can print up this section of the conversation to distribute it to shut-ins for inspirational things.
Well, what I'm wondering, John, is, I mean, do you make a living from covering and dealing with Judy Garland, or you do something else?
It's a life, but it's not a living. Let's just leave it at that.
All right. But this is exclusively what you do?
Well, yeah, more or less. I mean, I'm heading for the annual Wizard of Oz Festival in Indiana in September, the annual Wizard of Oz Festival in Kansas in October. I've already done them in her hometown in Minnesota in June and in upstate New York, the home of Frank Baum, the author of The Wizard of Oz. That was in June as well. So I do four of those a year, as a rule, lecturing and emceeing and presenting. And then there are other, opportunities. We just finished it was so exciting. A 4 weeks, it was called The Summer of Judy in New York, which is where I make my home. And the Film Society of Lincoln Center showed 31 of her 34 films in 54 different screenings. The Paley Center, which is the Museum of Television and Radio, showed between 40 and 50 of her TV appearances across 22 screenings. Mm-hmm. And I was the MC and the host and the Q&A guy for all of that. And again, it's a line that we use in the text of the new Judy film book. But again, the age range of the audiences was from fetal to fatal. You had kids of 5 or 6 who weren't just there to see Wizard of Oz. They were there to see Judy and Gene Kelly in Summer Stock. They were there to see Meet Me in St. Louis. And the people who came to the Paley Center, I think, were even more impressed because the movies are kind of familiar. But to find out that Judy Garland, as Judy Garland on TV, singing, talking, joking, whatever, was infinitely more interesting than any of the movie characters was a revelation to a lot of them.
Hmm.
But, my work involves all of that kind of stuff. It's not a lucrative field, certainly, but it is it's wonderful to wake up in the morning and know that you're going to enjoy what it is you're being asked to do.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. I
can't say much more than that without getting the internal revenue involved.
No, I hear you. I want to go back to the beginning of our conversation, though. There was one other thing you said after hello that I thought was interesting because I was asking you and I was sort of teasing about the need for yet another book about Judy or her career, and you made a point that I thought was really interesting and it bears going back to. You said that a lot of the books that were done before were done when people she worked with or even herself, I guess, were alive, and so things are said in that setting. And I know this from writing nonfiction and writing biography. Things are sometimes said when people are still alive that are different than they will say after they are gone. And you almost need another round of historians to go back and clean up a bit of history in that situation. I think that's what you're saying.
Well, more or less. I think you have to expand on that though, because I think that most people have. When she was alive, after she died, did nothing but rave about her as a human being and as a performer.
Mm-hmm.
But we know that there were a lot of peaks and valleys in Judy's 47 years. And a lot of the valleys were never explained in these books because the people responsible for the valleys were still alive.
Mm-hmm.
And so they could be very self-aggrandizing and offhand about, oh, well, Judy did this and Judy did that. But they couldn't say, well, Judy did this because she found out that her husband hadn't paid the taxes for 3 years, and that's why she was broke. Or Judy did that because her managers had embezzled $300,000, and she couldn't pursue that because she was working on her TV series, and it would have been too much unfavorable publicity. And again, she was, you know, we all have to take responsible for our own actions. I understand that. But she really, really tried so hard to get it right insofar as her business affairs, her personal affairs, the trouble she had on and off with prescription medication. None of this was put into perspective after she died, because, again, the principal players, you know, the fact that she married the wrong men again and again, or trusted the wrong men again and again, it must have been very difficult for someone who was as intelligent in many ways as she was to keep picking herself off and starting over and then realizing that she had yet again made some of the same mistakes. And that's only human. And it isn't a huge defense, but it's part of the perspective. And this is what was lacking from some of the, from many of the earlier books. I think, you know, the fact that the book I've just done, the one we're discussing, Judy, A Legendary Film Career by John Fricke, Running Press, is
I'll do the plugs around here, Philip.
Oh, all right, all right. Well, you hadn't said anything. So. But I think that, you know, the book is, you know, aggressively a celebration of her film career, you know, and the good reviews and the bad reviews and all the rest of it. But you'll find that it's very difficult to write a negative book about Judy Garland if you're going to tell the truth. Hmm. And this book kicks off with a 30-page biography that really does, I think, try to put stuff in perspective about her personal life. And again, it is only in the last 5 or 10 years that all the principal players are now gone, and you can talk more honestly about them than they ever talked about themselves.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's take a quick break. This is Bob Andelman, and you're listening to, and I forgot we're not doing video. Let me start that again.
Be my guest.
Hopefully I'll catch it in the editing. Let's take a quick break. This is Bob Andelman, and you're listening to the Mr. Media interview with Judy Garland historian John Fricke, whose new book is Judy, A Legendary Film Career. And we'll be right back.
You worked too hard, you ate too much, the cheesecake made you greedy. Let your aching head and stomach hear this message from Old Speedy. Alka-Seltzer, plop, plop, fizz, fizz. Oh, what a relief it is. Plop, plop, fizz, fizz. Oh, what a relief it is. Ah, those speedy Alka-Seltzer bubbles burst into action to relieve your upset stomach and aching head fast. If only as directed. Oh, what a relief it is. What a relief.
Hi, this is Raquel Welch. Yes, that Raquel. And I'd rather stick needles in my ears than listen to one more minute of Mr. Media Radio. Ugh.
Hey, folks. You can hear Mr. Media while on the go now with Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher is a free news and talk mobile app available for your smartphone, whether you use an iPhone, iPod Touch, Android, BlackBerry Curve, or Palm Pre. And when you download Stitcher to hear Mr. Media today, you have a chance to win some real money. Downloading is quick and easy. Just find Stitcher in your smartphone's app store. Download it. It's free. Takes seconds. Then, during registration, hit the promo code box and enter Mr. Media, that's MR Media, to get automatically entered to win $100. The latest episode of Mr. Media will be waiting for you in Stitcher's favorites right on your phone. You'll get access to lots of other amazing shows, too. Always available to you on demand, no syncing. Some of my favorites include WTF with Marc Maron, Plus One Per Diem with Kevin Smith, and The Nerdist with Chris Hardwick. It's all free and all instant to you on Stitcher Smart Radio. And don't forget to win the money. Enter promo code Mr. Media, MR Media, when you register. And thanks for listening. This is Bob Andelman, and you're listening to the Mr. Media interview with Judy Garland historian John Fricke, whose new book is Judy, A Legendary Film Career. John, I was kind of curious You were talking about people who are no longer with us, so you know the record is able to be cleared in some ways. But what about Judy Garland's surviving family members? In terms of, have any of them helped you over the years with your research and the development?
Oh, her daughter Lorna and her son Joe have helped many, many times. In fact, Lorna did the introduction to the book I did on Judy about 8 years ago, and that is a great compliment because the kids are very protective of their mom. They went through it all with her, and yet their take on her is very much a positive one. That, you know, then when things weren't good, they never felt they weren't loved. They never felt it had anything to do with them. It was just their mom trying to cope with all of the pressures that had been brought to bear on her life. And so to get not so much validation from them, but because they don't have anything to say as far as what I can or can't write, but they appreciate the fact that I know the information I know and that I kind of put it forth. And I think they appreciate the perspective more than anything else.
And what about the daughter with the Z in her name?
I don't, you know, Liza has her own life and her own career and has never been, I see that she gets copies of whatever I do about her mom, but, you know, that's about the only communication that has been necessary.
I wondered about that because it was, you know, listen, Judy had two famous daughters, one a little more famous than the other, the way things worked out. And I noticed in the acknowledgments to this book that Liza Minnelli, for if there's anybody out there who doesn't know what we're talking about, not mentioned. And I thought, I mean,
I don't bother Liza because there really isn't any need to. You know, that she has said what she is going to say, and to ask her for more, I've just never found it essential. If I were writing a book about the personal life, then it would be something else. But, you know, this is about the career, and they never made a movie together, unless you want to count the last, you know, 15 seconds of In the Good Old Summertime.
Nah, I don't count it. Well, so who is the family keeper of the flame? Is it Lorna or is there someone
else? Oh, definitely Lorna.
Okay.
Lorna's the one who she's very, very sane, very stable, very well adjusted, very clear-eyed. She also has been, you know, as you mentioned, a success as a performer, and she's also been a success as a person, as a mom. She has two really, really beautiful children, Jesse, who is now, I believe, 27, and Vanessa, who is around 20. And they're bright and attractive and down-to-earth and proud of their parents and proud of their grandmother. And, again, very quiet about all this, but very, very, very quietly proud.
And where are the, and this is sort of what we were talking about before, but where are the landmines in writing about Judy Garland? I mean, in other words, you know, what is a little ticklish to cover for friends and family, even in doing a book, you know, about her films?
Oh, I don't think anything is ticklish at this point unless you, you know, make just blatant misstatements based on legend and myth as opposed to, you know, really doing the work and finding out the truth. I think that, you know, for me, in just doing this apart from the family, it's just you hear, oh, well, this picture took so long to make, and this picture took so long to make, and this picture took so long to make. Yet if you actually go back and look, you know, you'll have people saying, oh, Wizard of Oz, you know, took 2 years, or Summer Stock took, you know, a year to make. And it's like, no, these are blatant, again, self-aggrandizing comments by people who have their own axes to grind. And yet, for example, one of the things we cover in the new book, there's a section called The Ones That Got Away, and it discusses five films that Judy started and didn't complete, one of which was the musical Royal Wedding with Fred Astaire. And there's a quote in Stanley Donen's biography, who directed that film, saying, we just couldn't get Judy to come in, meaning for rehearsals and things like that. You know, she wouldn't come in. And it's like, well, if you look at the production files for Royal Wedding at USC and the Arthur Freed Collection, Judy came in every day she was supposed to come in. She wasn't always on time, but she was there. And the people with whom she was working on her songs, Saul Chaplin and Johnny Green, you know, raved about the job she was doing. It's kind of like, fine, if you can say she was late, but don't say she didn't come in when she did on every scheduled day she was supposed to. That's a little piece of the mosaic, But there are so many pieces like that, and it's important, you know, just I don't think it's fair for someone to work as hard and as well as she did and just be printed as somebody who was, you know, lying around indulgently in the mansion for weeks at a time and wouldn't come to work.
Is it, have you found over the years writing about her and capturing her, that you've become more protective at this point of her and her legend than you were when you started?
No, I've become more declarative about it.
Okay.
When I started, I was, maybe, you know, you got to take all of this into account, and they said this, and, well, in the 25, 30, 40 years of research I've done, it is like, no, what you have to do on her behalf is clarify. And, you know, Stanley Donen may say what he said, but you can't let it stand as the all-time permanent, all-encompassing record when the paperwork and the legal files show something different. You've got to balance it. And that isn't so much protective as it is just, hey, wait a minute, you know, put in the rest of the story. I don't mean to sound like Paul Harvey, but I think that that's important. Again, because knowing her, the arc of her life, as some of us have come to know it, you see somebody who tried over and over and over and over to do the very, very best she could as much of the time as possible. And nobody succeeds all the time, nor did she. But she succeeded far, far more than some written history would have one believe. And when she didn't succeed, when she wasn't there, when she wasn't well, it's important to say why she wasn't or what were the extenuating circumstances. So I don't think that's so much protective as it is perspective. And I have gotten to be more declarative about it. It's kind of like, look, fellas, you know, tell if you're going to tell anything, tell as much of the truth as you can, not just one side of it. I think that segues to Irving Brecker, doesn't it?
Ah, Irving Brecker. I've heard of that man. Yes.
I will draw breath and let you talk occasionally.
No, that's okay. Yeah, I had mentioned during the break that I had read this book, The Wicked Wit of the West. It was Irving Brecker's autobiography, and then it wound up at the end. He had help from a writer named Hank Rosenfeld. And it's a fascinating book. Brecker wrote it in his early 90s, which is amazing in and of itself. And there's a section in here about Meet Me in St. Louis, which I gather that Brecker wrote.
He and Freddie Finkelhoff co-wrote the screenplay.
Yeah, and he tells the story about how Judy did not want to do the movie, and he got brought in because he claims in the book that he and Judy had been friends, and that he was encouraged to go and try to change her mind. And I guess he actually, I'm trying to find it while we've been talking, where he. I guess he read the script to her, and he downplayed Margaret O'Brien's part in his reading of the script so that she would feel that hers was a bigger part of it, more important to it. And he basically, I think, claims credit for getting her to make that movie. And I had kind of wondered if you were familiar with his book and his story about this.
Well, I'm familiar with his claim because we use a lot of audio quotes from him in the commentary track of the Meet Me in St. Louis DVD. They asked me to put that together, and I do the narration, but it segues in and out of quotes from, you know, audio quotes from Irving Brecker, from Margaret O'Brien, from Hugh Martin, the songwriter, people like that. I think again, Irving is telling it from his point of view, and I think there's probably truth to it, but I will read you a quote from the new Judy, A Legendary Film Career book that we've done. And it says, quote, "History has made much of the fact that Judy didn't want to do Meet Me in St. Louis, feeling it would be a mistake to regress from her roles in For Me and My Gal and Presenting Lily Mars to once again appear as a teenager." As an interlude, I can point out that Judy was 21 years old when she made Meet Me in St. Louis, and she was being asked again to play a 17-year-old.
Right.
Okay, the quote goes on to say, her dissatisfaction with Meet Me in St. Louis can be traced even more pointedly to the early meandering scripts for the film.
Mm-hmm.
As originally written, Esther Smith and her actions were alternately coy, simpering, or one-dimensional. And it's absolutely true. The early Meet Me in St. Louis scripts were dreadful, and they involved all kinds of extraneous subplots about Esther, Judy's character, being caught in the hotel room closet of Colonel Darley, with whom Judy was hoping to set up her older sister, not knowing that Colonel Darley was already married and he was going to sue the Smith family, or his wife was going to... I mean, it just went on and on and on, and it was very girly-girly and very stupid, those early scripts. And that is a great deal, has a great deal to do with why she didn't want to do the picture. Now, whether it was under Finkelhoff or Brecker that it was rewritten to become the very simple story it was, or Brecker and Finkelhoff working under the guidance of Vincent Minnelli, who replaced George Cukor as the director of the film, again, there are all of these pieces of the mosaic that you've got to factor in. All of them touched upon Judy's not wanting to do the picture and Judy's finally wanting to agree to do the picture. But I don't think you can emphasize one over another. You have to kind of... you can't make the cake unless you put in all the ingredients.
Got it.
I can't believe I said that.
Well, and okay, so I appreciate you touching on that. And I want to steer us back around now to the photos in this book, which we talked a little about before. One of the reasons I thought this book worked so well is because of its organization, which is chronological. But the photos, we can actually see because it's movie by movie by movie over the period of her film career, we can see her changing. We can see first the teenager morphing into the young woman, into the adult, and then, you know, before you know it, you're moving into, you know, God, yes, Judy Garland had middle age.
Well, and especially in those days when middle age started, when you were 35 years old.
Yeah. It's one of the things I really liked about it, was because you did see this development. I mean, you know, in my mind, she's pretty much always going to be the age of Dorothy Gale. And so when you see this, of course, you know, she was a woman. She was a real person.
Well, and I think that's thank you for all of that, first of all. Second, I think that that's one point that the text of the book makes, too, in accompanying the pictures, is that, you know, through all those early years at Metro, as the perky teen, as the ingenue who put on the show with Mickey Rooney, as the young leading lady who was, you know, chased by Gene Kelly and Fred Astaire, as the woman then who did A Star is Born and Judgment at Nuremberg and A Child is Waiting, about a school for mentally challenged children, when she did her film, she didn't do many films in the 50s and 60s. In fact, there are only four across those two decades. But for two of them, she got Academy Award nominations, Star is Born and Judgment at Nuremberg. The other two, A Child is Waiting and I Could Go On Singing, if not huge box office successes, were much more adult. All four of those films were much more adult than anything she did at MGM. So her career and her acting challenges really evolved with the decade. She wasn't still playing Dorothy Gale when she was 40 in the film. She was playing a mother with an illegitimate son in one film, who happened to be an entertainer as well. She was playing, as I say, a teacher opposite a school head played by Burt Lancaster in a Stanley Kramer, John Cassavetes movie about the challenges of special needs children. Again, Judgment at Nuremberg, about the judges who were being tried in Germany for cooperating with all the various Nazi plots and regimes. That's you jump from there back to Dorothy Gale, and you see why the film career she had is legendary and why she still impacts. One of the things that was very apparent in all the quotes that we use in the book from coworkers, producers, directors, makeup people, hair people, co-stars, interviewers, is how real she always was on screen. Hmm. And that's why you can do a film festival in New York in the year 2011 and show films from the 30s and 40s where the plots themselves aren't especially believable, but she is very believable and pulls you right into the action. It's an amazing achievement, and there are comparatively few stars of her generation who have that kind of impact yet today on an audience. Hmm. I'm not saying there aren't any. I'm just saying comparatively few.
Right. I understand. Well, before we wrap up, I got to ask you, as much time as you've spent studying Judy, writing about Judy, talking about Judy, she's obviously held in very high esteem by film fans, but is there anything for which you think she is underappreciated or was in her time?
Well, in her time, I think, again, she was so natural on the screen that she was never regarded as acting. You know, acting was something that Greer and Betty and Joan did. You know, Judy was just Judy, but it turns out that there's absolutely nothing affected about it. There's nothing over the top about it. It's just all of this sincerity and vulnerability. Now, those were the traits she had as a human being, and that ultimately worked against her, because the last thing you can be in show business is sincere and vulnerable. If you want to last, you get, I think, trampled as a result. But I think that certainly history has proven the truth of every rave she got in films between 1936 and 1963. And the fact that they're still being shown and enjoyed and still having the impact. As I said, I'll be going to an Oz festival, a couple of them over the next few weeks, and there will be literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of little girls in blue and white dresses and red shoes. And I've been doing these Oz festivals since the 50th anniversary of the film in 1989, when there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of little girls dressed that way. And I remember thinking 22 years ago, this has got to be the peak. It can't get bigger than this. It can't sustain this. Well, bingo, here we are, and it not only has, but the little girls I'll be seeing in the next couple of weeks are more or less the daughters of the ones I saw 22 years ago. And I think that is a lovely thing. So much of my email comes from teenagers around the world saying, we have just seen Judy Garland in such and such. Where can we see more? Or we heard her sing Old Man River on YouTube. Wow. Or Battle Hymn of the Republic, or As Long as He Needs Me, or material from her TV series. It just doesn't go away, because there were very few people like her. There are fewer people like her today with that kind of, who's standing there singing live, not surrounded by snakes and flash powder and, all of that kind of stuff. There's room for all of it.
Right.
But I think what makes her film career and her entire career as legendary as it is the fact that you got all of that talent and all of that communication neat, as it were. And that's a very rare thing. You're getting a sense of the person and of the, as you said at the beginning, the God-given gifts.
Well, John, is there a next book already lined up? Are you working on?
No. Right now I'm working on a nap. I think we've got the 75th anniversary of the Wizard of Oz movie coming up in 2014. There will certainly be projects connected to that with which I hope I can be involved. I would love to do a companion book to this one that would give the same kind of detail about her TV, stage, recording, and radio work, because then you'd have another great, he said, hopefully great volume that has that history in it for access.
The radio
work. But it all depends
great.
What they're buying.
Yeah, I've heard my wife and my daughter and I are all big fans of old radio stuff from the 30s and 40s, and a lot of the stuff she did in especially the comedies where she would be with Bob Hope or Jack Benny or whoever she was on with, she was very funny and she had a very good handle on what worked for her in that medium. She was always
well, and again, not afraid to ad lib. It was all scripted. But
yep.
Bing Crosby is on record as saying that she was the most talented person of anybody with whom he worked. And they never got to do TV or film, but they did hours and hours on radio. And she was just his favorite because she was funny. She was musical. She did dialects. She did hillbilly and Western and all kinds of crazy stuff. Again, there's a facet of her talent that maybe people don't know.
Well, folks, listen, you can order Judy Garland historian John Fricke's fascinating new book, Judy, A Legendary Film Career, in great bookstores everywhere, or order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com. And, John, do you have a website? Are you on any social media where people can find you?
No, my email is just johnfricke@AOL.com. And Facebook, I owe about 250 emails by actual count right now, so I'm not looking to go to Twitter or Tweeter or Facebook or, anything like that. It's nice to think that I might be well-received if I did, but I'll handle it as best I can, just the old-fashioned email kind of way.
Got it, got it. Well, John Fricke, it's a beautiful book, a fascinating look at someone I think most people think they already know a lot about, but they have a lot to learn, apparently. And thank you so much for joining us on Mr. Media today.
Well, thank you for the forum. These were great questions, and I love to talk about this, and it's nice to talk about it in this depth as opposed to, what is your favorite Judy Garland song, Mr. Frick? So I appreciate all of that, too.
My pleasure. It was just very nice to talk to you today.
Anytime at all, Bob. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, and continued good luck.
Thanks.
All right. For more original interviews, surf over to our main website, MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. If you've enjoyed today's show, subscribe for free to Mr. Media via email, RSS, or iTunes, and you'll never miss a show. Another good idea, download our new free Mr. Media mobile app in the Android market. And you can also listen with a piece of string and a tin can in many parts of the Internet. Show your support of Mr. Media by supporting our sponsors, including Audible. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/radio. Again, that's audibletrial.com/radio for your free audiobook. We're also supported by thepartyauthority.us. Call DJ Ira for all your party entertainment needs nationwide at 1-800-DIAL-DJS or visit their website, thepartyauthority.us. If you've got an idea for a guest, a comment on today's show, or would like to advertise on Mr. Media Radio, email me directly at bob@mrmedia.com, mrmedia.com. You can also call our 24-hour listener line at 1-727-498-4711. Some messages may be used in an upcoming show. And unless you live next door to Mr. Media, there may be a toll charge. You can also follow Mr. Media on Facebook, Twitter, or our new YouTube and Vimeo video channels. Thanks so much for joining us today. I always appreciate you sharing a piece of your day with Mr. Media. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching.
I'm saxophonist Mindy Avair, and you're listening to Mr. Media. Maybe watching, huh?